Hello and welcome to the seventh episode of the MIR podcast, a show dedicated to science education, focusing on climate change, urban heat adaptation and climate restoration using surface reflection technology. I'm Peter Dines, a director at MIR, and I am the host for this podcast. Today we're happy to have Dr. Tao join us once again to be our educator on this journey. Dr. Tao is the founder and director of MIR, which stands for Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing. He established the organization to tackle the greatest threat humanity has ever faced, namely climate change. Before setting up MIR, Dr. Tao was a fellow running a lab at Harvard's Rowland Institute. MIR is a non-profit organization focusing on surface SRM, solar radiation management, adaptation and mitigation research, as well as climate education, which this podcast is obviously part of. Over time, we'll be discussing everything related to climate reality, feasible mitigation, urban heat adaptation to the latest scientific papers, and ongoing updates with the MIR project. If you've any suggested topics that you wish us to cover, you can tweet us at MIR SRM, that's MEERSRM on X, or alternatively, contact us through the website info@mir.org. As I mentioned, the organization is a non-profit. We're currently funded by individual donors, so any donations are always welcome to further our research and humanitarian efforts. You can go to mir.org/donate to contribute. In this episode, we'll discuss Dr. Tao's ongoing trip to China, and we'll also delve into the critical topic of agriculture, crop yields, and how the MIR concept can help with the severe impact of climate change on our food systems.
And just to start us off, obviously, you're still in China, yay. So just wondering if you have any updates from there and what's been happening and any potential collaborations, etc.
So I've been in China for about 2 months. So this trip is intended to get a sense of where academia is in China in climate research, agriculture research and water resources, etc. So as you can imagine, the country is pretty large, but thankfully it's well connected by train, high-speed train. One can get to most places where these research activities go on in this area about a day. So I was able to travel away from Guangzhou, which is in the south of China, up to as far north as Beijing, the capital, where I visited their multiple universities, these research groups, for example, in Tsinghua University, Beijing University. These are the MIT and Harvard equivalent of China, as well as several groups in the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Generally, the concept has been very well received, and people are interested in potentially participating and collaborating. The main challenge, I think, for China is that researchers and group leaders do not have full freedom in choosing really the topic of research. They're under the state-funded structure, so they more or less have to perform the type of research that's handed down to them. And sporadically, there are, let's say, projects over 1, 2, or 3 years that come up stochastically. And the colleagues I talk to say they cannot really turn down like these random occurrences of very topic-specific research projects, because if they did, then in the future, the program managers wouldn't come to them anymore. There's relatively little leverage or ability to direct really what it is that one wants to do the research on. And a lot of research directions are based on carbon capture related topics, including the impact of deforestation on the climate. So I think the Chinese system in that sense is lagging behind the state of the art understanding in other locations, including say, the UK and in the States. And rather top-down directed approach is not really compatible with introducing a concept of avant-garde or unconventional as MIR, in the short term at least, to be the mainstream research community inside China. Now, that's a unfortunate discovery of this trip. But that aside, I think it's good to see that people are trying really hard to work on different things. The state here really invests a lot of resources in trying to do the right thing. Based on their best understanding, most of which is informed by the teachings of the IPCC and the mainstream renewable energy, transition, interested research groups in the States and in Europe. So they're trying to do a lot. One example is that if you go to the province of Tibet, in the capital city of Lhasa, if you look around, you will see the greenery trees around all the distant mountains. And the altitude over there is, I think, 12,000 feet. So nothing is supposed to really grow, but the party wants to make sure that there's a environmental remediation. So they spend, I don't even know how much money, to install a drip irrigation system over all the surrounding mountains and also concretize the catchment for water to ensure that whatever snow melts, rainwater gets retained so that you can also apply soil. Yeah, they actually imported soil and put on those mountains. It's quite an impressive account of what happened in that region by one of the colleagues I got to know here in Beijing. Yeah, so those are some fun things to know about the trip.
Wow, Pukseti. It sounds like a mega project's taking place there, especially in that area around Tibet. Yeah, look, we're here today to talk about our project in more detail in terms of agriculture. And just look at our recent studies, including one that was published in Nature Foods, supported by NASA. And they suggested that there's going to be significant impacts from climate change on crop yields. And the likes of maize even could be down around 20% by as early as 2030 under those emission scenarios that we're still on. Emission scenarios are probably worse currently. So how could MIR's technology potentially help us address the declines in those crop yields predicted?
I think the field of the climate simulations and crop, it's an ongoing field. And sporadically, there's paper published every few months on different projections using different types of models for specific regions. And the general consensus is that you're looking at anywhere from like the 10 to 90% drop in yield in the next decade. So there's a huge range of uncertainty. And a lot of the uncertainty are due to, of course, different assumptions. One, and then second is our current inability to really have a climate model which is a faithful representative of what actually happens on climate. Most climate models, so they are based on what's called the general circulation model, are simulations or models of the Earth system with a relatively large poor spatial resolution. Typically, they represent each 100 miles by 100 miles square, which means they do tens of miles to 100 miles square area as one single pixel. You can imagine how poor a resolution that is, because even over several meters, several feet, you're going to have a vastly different soil properties, different albedo, different greenhouse gas emission properties, response to any interaction with clouds, which happen on the scale of meters to a few kilometers. So climate models, they suffer from this poor resolution, which then translates into a lot of downstream problems, and most notable of which is their inability to represent the cloud processes very accurately. Yet cloud processes, one of which is the precipitation, and evaporation, these are absolutely crucial for understanding impact on agriculture, especially to extrapolate and understand the impact of extreme weather events on agriculture. There are some studies currently emerging that suggest that the proportion of precipitation, say over the United States, that are represented by what's called the, or delivered by what's called mesoscale convective system, will increase in the future. Mesoscale convective systems are like clouds or rain clouds, circulation patterns on the order of a few kilometers, a few hundred, maybe up to low thousand kilometer range. So they cover like several states, several regions. They're relatively small on the meteorological scale, compared to larger one with north scale. So these mesoscale simulations, they really need much finer understanding of the cloud spatial 3D processes accurately represent. And if the proportion of precipitation, notably like these rainbow local extreme precipitation, were to become even more pronounced, become the majority of precision in the future, then if you don't have those nailed down in your model, which are not possible to represent the current global circulation model, then there's a little chance for these models to deliver faithful or trustworthy future projections of property. And if you pay attention, corn yields are certainly down in many locations in the world, notably this year in Southern Europe. Serbia, Hungary, and surrounding states have suffering on the order of 40% drop in yield in 2024. And the extreme event drought is also affecting the rice yield in Japan, and there's news of people unable to buy rice in supermarkets for about 2 months. Hopefully, apparently the yields for this year is probably okay. So the shortage currently is one of the most rich countries maybe alleviate. But certainly the prognosis going forward is not great. And there certainly needs to be a solution to act to prevent extreme events from continuing to erode our agricultural yield.
Okay, look, it's really concerning to see the extent of the disruption to agriculture that we're seeing currently, which is linked to obviously global heating. If successfully deployed, how would that protective technology, how could it possibly mitigate the harm to crops and maybe mitigate the harm to crop yields?
So the impact or intended impact of MIR is to reduce the speed at which water gets lost from agricultural fields. So the reason why water is necessary for agriculture is that plants need to thermoregulate. Their leaves and photosynthesis components work optimally at a temperature of about 30 degrees Celsius. But under sunlight, leaves temperature generally gets much warmer, about 30. And in order to maintain optimal photosynthetic rate, plants need to expand the water to carry away the heat as what's called latent heat. So essentially through evaporation, some of the heat that's generated by the sunlight is away. And this process is called transpiration. And it happens through the stomata, basically like opening, microscopic openings on the leaf that both enables CO2, one of the components or ingredients for photosynthesis, to enter the leaf by diffusion, but also enables water to come out as a vapor after it has undergone the process of evaporation. So the process of transpiration of water leaving the leaf is also a very sensitive function of the surface temperature of the leaf. As you can imagine, if the process is more or less analogous to the drying of a pot of water. And if it's near freezing, then the water will stay around for a long time. Whereas if the temperature is higher, similar relative humidity, then the water will dry much faster. So the speed of water loss has been found to be a exponential function of the temperature of the leaf surface. Then the idea is that if you can reduce the temperature of the leaf surface, then you can reduce how much of the evaporation happens by two mechanisms. Fundamentally, if there's less heating of the whole environment, if the leaf are able to stay closer to their optimal photosynthetic temperature of not too much over 30 degrees Celsius, then there's not essentially as much need for getting rid of the heat through the consumption of water. So the fundamental logic in passive radiative cooling is to provide a cooler environment, both in surrounding air temperature, and also if you apply this passive cooling and lead to direct shading of the leaf, also dramatic reduction of leaf surface temperature. So the need for water irrigation or rain fed would dramatically decrease. And so that's the direct intended consequence. And in terms of specific implementation, it really requires much more careful in-field assessment against many different parameters. Because in the end, agriculture is a system. It's a very complex system where if you change one thing, many other things will respond as well. And when you implement, say, a MIR mitigation process, maybe you don't need your irrigation setup anymore or the same extent. So the fractions with this passive, fully induced water economy and displace currently active forms of irrigation to achieve essentially the same result of optimized photosynthetic. But the balance of that requires really new field assessment. However, we can make some initial guesstimates. So there are some data on, for instance, how much a very single component of the whole irrigation equator consumes in electricity. Just consider the pump needed to deliver water through the pipe for a drip irrigation or sprinkler-based system. One generally finds that in order to irrigate 1 hectare plant over a year, one needs to expend between 2,000 to 8,000 kilowatt hour of electricity for the irrigation. And if we translate that into what is the current global mix or energy or carbon intensity of power production, that translates into about 1 to 4 tons of CO2 emissions just by running the pump to provide water for irrigation. And in comparison, let's say we were to implement our current MIR prototype over a 1 hectare plant, we would have expended about 800 kilograms of carbon of CO2 to make the infrastructure. So the embodied carbon expenditure for making a MIR system for local fully over 1 hectare is much less than the lower bound estimate for how much fuel is needed just to run the pump for irrigation. Of course, in the build out of the irrigation system, the manufacturing of the pump, delivery, et cetera, will incur additional embodied life cycle emissions for the irrigation system. Right? Whereas the figure that I mentioned for MIR is kilograms. That includes everything, manufacturing, delivery, and installation. Because after you install it, the passive system, there's no more concurrent energy expenditure after the system functions, or very little. Right? Of course, there's maintenance involved, annual maintenance, which is unavoidable, whether you're dealing with a passive mirror-based system or an active drip irrigation or sprinkler irrigation system. In the end, that's to say that there's many of these things to consider, and what I mentioned here is just one small example of the whole equation, going from seed, fertilizer, service to the product, and delivery to the market. Another very important piece to consider is change in yield. Let's say additional irrigation was able to improve your yield by a factor 100, so that's doubling your yield. Then you have to see whether MIR can deliver comparable yield increases, or say only 30-40%. Then the difference in investment, then the difference in improvement in yield, both of those and expenditure and reward need to be taken into account in calculating the financial economic feasibility of the infrastructure. But no doubt, if the passive technology like MIR is applied, it will be certainly beneficial for water saving. It will be certainly delivering cooling benefits locally and also regionally, and eventually globally. But unfortunately, these larger scale benefits, co-benefits, which need much better coordination and also research fully understand, is not part of the calculus in the current single producer based economic assessment. So in order for a MIR to practically to larger scale, we really need a much better experimental understanding of the engineering set of thought. But also the impact for different crop groups, fruits, vegetables that are tested. So there's a lot of fundamental science to be done, engineering to be done before much more can be said about the intervention.
It certainly sounds like there's a lot of research to be done indeed. And beyond the crops as well, as we know, agricultural workers are increasingly enduring really harsh conditions, resulting in significant health issues as well, and lost productivity, I suppose, also. So could MIR's technology potentially improve working conditions for people who are working in agricultural fields also?
Most certainly. Actually, that's a much easier task to accomplish. than really fully understanding the economic and agricultural impact. Because relatively speaking, a person is a much smaller surface area to protect against the unwanted radiation. And there's a flurry of activity going on in the material science field, both in the startup space and also in academia, trying to produce various passive radiative cooling fabric. And some of which have already been made into t-shirts that the agricultural workers could be wearing when they're out in the field. And the laboratory scale experiments are consistent with 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, maybe up to 8 Fahrenheit cooling of the surface of such fabric under direct solar radiation. So that definitely would improve the thermal comfort of agricultural workers if these technologies in textile based on similar principles of, you know, light reduction and IR emission are applied in that context. But one can also think about constructing like the resting station that's passively cooled to enable periodic rest, so the chances for heat stroke can be reduced. I would expect small demonstration projects such as these to be carried out in the next year, probably before like comprehensive agricultural yield data can be taken. I think that's definitely one more near-term future we are looking at.
Yes, absolutely. And hopefully we will have some sort of prototypes for that purpose developed in the next 6 to 12 months. Now, obviously, agrivoltaics and solar panels are vying for similar lands, and space becomes a premium resource in terms of people wanting to generate energy as well. Can MIR's technology be integrated with other solutions like solar panels to optimize the use of the land without compromising agricultural productivity?
Okay, yeah. So first of all, I don't think there's like any competition between the two approaches, because both are addressing different parts of the climate problem. Agrivoltaic is indeed one prime example of mitigation effort, with mitigation defined being actions taken to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases. And obviously, by displacing, hopefully, part of the fossil fuel use on farming community, agrivoltaic would accomplish a mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions. But as we know, in our community especially, that full transition to renewables has no longer been sufficient. Full transition to renewables is no longer sufficient to prevent further temperature increases and the eventual collapse of the agricultural system. So we also need to work on the locked-in warming, the thermal extreme aspect of getting the situation under control, which we call thermal mitigation, which in essence is a more direct intervention on the primary source of the problem, which is that's thermal energy in our system, right? As opposed to conventional greenhouse gas mitigation, which is trying to tackle the thermal problem indirectly through greenhouse gas. So agrivoltaic and agrimir are addressing two different components of the problem. Agrivoltaic is trying to slow down the rate we call future harm, whereas the agrimir is trying to deal with the current and ongoingly worsening thermal extreme weather impact on agricultural productivity. So there is a conceptual difference there. Secondly, there's also a competition between the two techniques in terms of space, because we are using 10% of the global surface area for agriculture. And sunlight is a very powerful form of energy. And a very small fraction of that surface would be sufficient to deliver the electricity that we currently need globally. And what's more challenging is to integrate whatever solar panel is rolled out on field into either existing grid or finding ways to store that energy so it actually it's being used. Because a lot of the PV that we roll out in around the world, and especially in China, are only there for show. They're not really or yeah, whatever power or capturing or whatever.
All right, very interesting.
A small fraction of that is delivered to the end user, much of which is actually wasted. And there is a lot of story that I heard on this trip to China about the most or a potential majority of the recent rollout in panel not really yet been connected to the grid. So it's counted as installed gigawatt powered, but it's not really serving any practical function as they currently. So my point now is that there's sufficient land to put all of them, and the challenge in agrivoltaic and really thinking about how to integrate them into the energy consumption system. And in parallel, Agrimir needs to be rolled out to counter recent disasters such as the drying of crop fields, forest fields in Serbia in Hungary. And there's not enough resource in these countries or around the world to enable coverage as the real agricultural scale by agrivoltaic is the price of panels. And supporting infrastructure is simply prohibitive. Roughly speaking, for 1 square meter of PV panel to be purchased, so one needs to spend about $30 US at if you're buying bulk from a manufacturer. Because most of the panel nowadays are produced in China, then factoring in shipping costs and the importation costs, which easily drive up the panel cost to about $100 US per square meter delivered or installed as one property. And a few $100 US typically is in profits, let's say, is typical of per hectare profit in many parts of the world. And mind you, there's 10 to the 4th power meter squared in the hectare. The cost of installing these systems is, in many cases, quite challenging, prohibitive. It's next to impossible, especially for the global south, where like mitigation, true thermal direct mitigation is mostly, if most needed. But in contrast to the hundreds to thousands of dollars per square meter of installs of agrivoltaic, current MIR systems can deliver that between the single digit dollars to make sense with the economy of scale, possible to drop that into the single dollar range, which would make the thermal and evaporation protection of extra scale of field to be within or comparable to the yearly revenue, not revenue, the yearly profit of the cultivation of the area. And if the system can be made durable on the Kato time scale, then the investment was most fairly economic fit. And the synergies, you also mentioned about potential synergy between the two.
Yes.
I think, one of the critiques of photovoltaics in general is that the surface of a PV panel is much darker than most underlying surfaces, be it their agricultural fields with the albedo of 0.2 or urban areas with an albedo of 0.34. PV has, they have a surface albedo like 0.05 to 0.1. So they're absorbing between 10 and 30% more light than covering that. So the installation of these energy production facilities, especially at or near the point of consumption by humans, close to human habitation, can increase local air temperatures by a good fraction to several degrees Celsius. And that can be the difference between life and death, especially on the extreme heat situation. The problem of photovoltaic heat island effect compounding or contributing to urban heat island effect is going to be an area of research and policy discussion going forward. But near, I think we can propose a new concept, which I've recently heard talk about, called the albedo neutral land use modification. Meaning that when one is trying to improve the productivity or utility of any piece of engineered human use the wind, we want to try to not at least reduce the albedo of that piece of land fully made to use it first. So let's say if we were to change part of this field into agrivoltaic system and let at least introduce a small fraction of the mirror area relative to the PV panel area, but that's the overall area averaged of the, that's not age relative to the background unmodified uncovered property, albedo neutral or albedo positive land use modification to become a topic of research.
Yes, and it's certainly not what's happening, what you were mentioning at the start in Tibet. If they're covering that area with more grasses, it's probably albedo negative, which is not what's probably needed. This has been spoken for quite a long time already, so I'll just leave it with one more question. And it's more about climate justice as well, and these type of mitigation, thermal mitigation schemes, because obviously there are a few different ones, and MIR is one of them. In terms of a democratic solution, you know, how does MIR compare? Because obviously you're talking about large scale projects here. So how is it more democratic to develop a ground-based system?
I think it would be democratic in the sense that, let's say, farmers in the global south, many of them like small-scale artisanal farmers, they more or less have jurisdiction over their land. And historically speaking, people are willing to try different low-tech technologies if the use of such technologies can improve yields and ultimately lead to economic benefit for the user, which in this case are the small local producers. I think that as an example, if I remember well, more efficient irrigation and water management practices have been used on the order of 10 to 20%, say in India in the past decade, following like KF3. Useful advances are being taken up by small scale. The use of technology would be, in that case, democratic to each individual user who has what jurisdiction over their piece of land and make individualized decisions based on a local specific, whether it makes agricultural, scientific sense to do the intervention locally, whether it makes economic sense, whether it makes compatible with the local beliefs, whether there's a community buy-in, surrounding communities, whether that's coordinated efforts. These are, in most cases, entirely the decision of the owners of the land or people who are performing agriculture on rented land. That's why the mechanism, by design, is democratic. Of course, there might be, it's conceivable that certain governments or local authorities simply make this illegal to implement such an intervention, but it's hard to imagine why that would be the case. If the intervention is good for the local economy, it's good for local thermal mitigation. Well, that's a possibility. It's not clear why, what mechanism that could arise. And very importantly, when one performs AgriMIR, which is a form of local solar management, solar radiation management, or solar radiation optimization, the local temperature impact is very remarkable relative to some more centralized SRM techniques, solar radiation management techniques such as marine cloud grinding or stratospheric aerosol injection, which are much more diffuse or are applied at locations that's much farther away from where people are performing agriculture or living. But by the time this form of remote or very dilute, visually dilute cooling reaches the people, the cooling benefit is actually much reduced. Whereas in the case of on the ground, in the field application, mirror reflection or other radiant cooling techniques, there's very strong local cooling. And relatively speaking, there's very little also potential for negative impact on the circulation scale before there's the bottom-up democratic form of adaptation deals to above 10% of global agricultural coverage area. Historically, humans have been making changes to the land, increasing, decreasing the albedo, typically on average, an increase in albedo, which has offset part of the greenhouse gas warming. So I think the radiative cooling from historical land use changes about 0.1 slightly more than 0.1 watt per meter per average globally. And there still seems to be like a very strong signal in global circulation service that's associated with this 0.1 watt per meter per global cooling. And in the case of MIR, if it were to scale this, you know, sort of 10-15% of global agricultural area, we would see a meaning that all of the surface area that in use for agriculture is covered by the 10-15% of reflectors radiated coolers that we would see on the order of 1 or 2 watts per meter squared of cooling. Initially, as in the initial year, or even one decade, it's probably more realistic to expect only 10% of farm land to implement this local water saving temperature reduction technology, which would lead to about order 0.1 watt per meter squared of cooling globally. And this level of cooling is not expected to induce very strong or measurable global circulation changes. So the typical concerns about solar radiation management, which includes the solar connection effect, unintended consequences of a war harm elsewhere than the sum of local immediate benefits. That component is not as much of a concern because of the scale and the fact that we really need to have a global buy-in in the end to need to be worried about unintended and unequal distribution of benefit. I think those two points together show that how this technology is democratic.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Yay. And listen, I've got to leave it there because the line is not brilliant and it's getting late there as well in China also. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for hosting. Thanks to everyone for listening in. And I'll see you next time.
Okay, so once again, we'll have to leave it there as we've come to the end of our time on this Episode 7 podcast. I want to thank Dr. Tao for his time and once again for his brilliant insights into these very important subjects that we all need to fully understand. Hopefully we've all learned something new today. I know I have. We'll hopefully be back again next month delving in deeper into the science and hearing updates on the project. Thanks to everyone who tuned into the live stream and for those listening to the recording. I hope you found the conversation useful and enlightening. Just a reminder, you can follow our developments on the website MIR.org or follow our X Twitter feed at MIRSRM. And once again, MIR is a non-profit. We really do appreciate any donations you can make towards our ongoing research and humanitarian efforts. To donate, go to MIR.org/donate. Thanks again, and until next time, stay informed, stay engaged, and speak then.